Hello, and welcome to the very, very first ever episode of Cannonballs. I'm Gemma Kaneko.
I'm Ben Cosman.
And this is a book podcast. We're here to dive into the literary canon, and by dive, we mean just burst into it like a kid at a public pool, ruining everything for everybody.
It's
Cannonballs. That's with two N's and a Z.
Yes.
Because we are classy, and that is how we like to spell things. So what happens on this podcast is we pick a book from the literary canon that perhaps we have not read or haven't read in a long time, but is widely appreciated, and we feel we probably should have read by this point in our lives. We read it, we talk about it, and we're going to have a guest every time who either really loves the book or has some specific expertise about the book. And this week we have Katie Boland.
Hello.
Who has read our book, Little Women, 10 times.
So she claims.
Yes.
I mean, honestly, I'm not even sure, but we're going to say that.
So why is Little Women so important to you and obviously a classic to everyone?
Well, it definitely formative book for me. Read it like right at that age where just like books stick with you super hard, like 8 or whatever. Isn't that like when your brain is still elastic or whatever? I have no idea.
I think that's right.
Something like that.
Yeah,
that
sounds right.
I don't know. I just found it so like satisfying as a kid. You know, it was like 4 girls and they all had like distinct personalities, and like Amy always wore blue and Joe always wore red. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I just found that characterization extremely satisfying as a young child.
I hear Katie, but I feel like anyone who would listen to this podcast, almost our entire audience is going to be people who are like, I'm a Joe. But you are an Amy.
Oh, absolutely.
I do feel
that. Because Amy, okay, so, all right, how do I explain this? So basically right now, you know, everyone's like having a lot of nostalgia for Sex and the City right now. I mean, they always have, but like, I feel like it's at an extreme right now. And like, Miranda is getting her due right now. And I feel that Amy is going to get her due eventually, because Joe, obviously, you know, I get it. She's relatable. She's like, oh, I'm not. I think that's what bothers me about her. She was like not like the other girls.
She was afraid of or ashamed of being girly.
Something like that. But she just played that up. And I've never been a fan of that. I remember like in, oh, God, here we go. We can also talk about this maybe another time. American Girls, Gemma.
Yes, I know. Yes. American Girls. I had Felicity.
Yes, exactly. So I remember Kit was like, oh, I like baseball. I don't like cooking. And I'm like, I like cooking. Like, what's the big deal? You know, so it's just like, oh, I'm different. And I was like, no, I don't. I reject that. I like things. I like nice things. I get that it's painful not to be popular. Whereas Joe's like, why do you even care?
Later we're going to get to the story about how you burned your siblings' most treasured possessions. But before we do that, Ben, what are you?
I am going to say I identify as a Beth.
I
identify as a porcelain moments, porcelain figurine incarnate. So I'm Beth.
Ben is banned from the podcast.
You're a fragile soul.
All right. So at the beginning of every episode, every time we start a new book, we're going to give you a little bit of a scouting report on the book. So Ben and I both come from a baseball background. We watch a lot of baseball. I like baseball and cooking too. Okay,
totally.
So
exactly. Oh, God. I totally forgot that you guys are baseball people. I literally didn't even like remember that when I said that.
Anyway, so the way that scouting reports work in the sport of baseball is you will see a player and you will rate his abilities on a 20 to 80 scale. It's kind of intuitive. 20 is not so great. 80 is pretty incredible. That's what it is. Don't ask me why there's no 100. Just don't ask me. I have no answer for you. So we thought we would rate this book on a couple of categories. In baseball, you know, it's someone's arm, power, etc. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about classicness. Where would you rate this book in terms of classicness? Before we jump into our discussion, I would put it at an 80. I feel that most people
would
have read this book.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like so, it's elemental. Irreducible.
Yeah. It was a book my mother told me I should read, so I take that to be any classic.
Absolutely.
I did not read it as a child. I just read it a month ago started it a month ago as a 25-year-old boy, so.
Yeah, 80. I agree.
All right, that's pretty high up there, so I'm assuming a lot of you have read it, but accessibility is our next category, which to me says, like, how comfortable would a modern reader be with this text? Mm. I would put a little bit lower. I'd put it at 60. Just because, like you said, boys don't generally read this book, which is lame because you can also read it if you're a boy. But I do think that is the hurdle for probably a lot of people.
Yeah, I think that's probably why it isn't taught as much in schools anymore, because you're going to get a lot of resistance from boys. Like, this is dumb. I don't want to read about these dumb girls. But they're wrong, because this book is really good.
Yeah, no, I think I would agree with that as well. I think also the language, you know, sometimes it can be tiring if you just want to, like, chill and read something. It's like, oh, father. I mustn't.
I had a different impression of this book than when I read it about it. I thought it was more like Jane Eyre, where it was this really, I'm not going to say it's not deep, but this is a young adult novel, like the first young adult novel. I was not expecting that. So the language and the, I guess the moral arcs were a lot more straightforward and simple than I was expecting. But
well, she wrote it in like installments, right? It was like a paper, like every week in the paper or whatever.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it did not. I mean, part one was over before part two was even written.
Right, yeah.
And this was her sellout book, right?
It was definitely, talk about that a little bit later, but this is definitely her, like, I just want money.
Yeah.
Right. So finally, our last category in our scouting report is pop culture influence, which I would also put at an 80 because, again, it was pre Are You a Carrier, Samantha? It was pre Are You a Rachel or Phoebe? Whatever. This was the original, for a lot of people, like archetype female personality quiz thing. And there have been so many film adaptations and stage adaptations and et cetera, and like weird meta literary commentary novels on it. I feel like it's really just permeated pop culture very deeply.
Yeah. Any book with more than one movie adaptation is an 80.
Yeah, you're probably right. I guess I'm going to put it at 70 because I just wish it was being brought up more. I just feel like people because I just don't think people are making that connection. Like, you know, it's like it's totally the precursor to like, you know, Sex and the City, Are You a Carrie, whatever. Like, but people are not talking about it.
This podcast will start the Little Women revival.
Exactly. But people have forgotten. And they need to remember.
This is the spark for the zeitgeist. All right. So now we know about the book. We've talked about it. You kind of get a sense of what it is. If, like Ben, you've never read it before.
No.
We're talking about part one this episode. We're going to split this episode into two parts, just like the book itself. So part one, here we go. Let's dive in. We meet the Little Women. Amy, Beth, Joe, Meg, and their mother, who's called Marmee for some inexplicable reason.
Do they ever explain that? I don't think so.
It's just a cute way.
I guess.
Consider this is a flash forward, but considering how children speak in this book, like, yeah,
Mommy.
I guess maybe they added a random R. Like, I don't know. Just real, like, Worcester people or, like, Baltimore.
They are New England, right?
I guess they don't live that far from D.C. There's, like, a train to D.C.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
I thought they lived near Walden Pond.
Sure.
Weren't they like, well, okay. Sorry, in the movie, I completely forgot in the movie. They're like, my parents were transcendentalists.
Well, Alcott was, wasn't she, or the Alcotts were friends with Ralph Waldo Emerson.
Yeah, she had correspondence with Emerson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a scene.
So this book takes place during the American Civil War.
And mentions it maybe like once?
Well, they pass it. Like, that's where, so these five women are living in this house and they're in their genteel poverty and like making do.
That's so
and the father is gone. Mr. March, their last name is March, is gone. And it's because he's a chaplain in the Civil War.
Yeah.
And
he was a chaplain?
He was.
Yeah, because he's kind of old, so he's not a soldier.
Oh, I didn't even catch that. Wow. Okay.
And he's treated as if like this sort of godlike figure who will judge them upon returning.
Oh my
every
god!
Time,
it's so true.
Every time something happens, they're like, "Oh, what will Father think?
Yeah.
Who cares? He's not here right now.
Have fun."
But also, this is Little Women is probably the least controversial book written about the Civil War.
Yeah,
or like in the fact that it doesn't talk about any of the issues surrounding the Civil War at all. Like, there's, I think, one mention of slavery sort of alluded to.
Is there? I didn't even catch that.
They talk about freed slaves at one point.
I didn't even catch that at all.
But that is the closest they ever come. And I think Alcott sort of said that was purposeful, where she's like, I'm just going to sell this book. Anyone can read it. I just want to make bank. yeah. And, you know, I mean, power to you, but it is a little weird that
there's only one point where it's even clear what side of the Civil War he's on, because Marmee is making blue coats for soldiers. So it's like, okay, well, they're not gray, so we know he's in the Union. Like, he's fighting for the Union.
For being such a moralistic novel, it doesn't really try to moralize about slavery, which was
pretty intense.
But to be fair, I think Alcott was a pretty big abolitionist.
Yeah.
So she, you know, she has her cred. She just did not include it in this novel.
Which I guess if she wanted as many people as possible to just pay her, that makes sense. That's definitely like the Republicans buy sneakers too situation.
Yeah, that's pretty fair, I guess.
Yeah. So Ben, you thought this was going to be a much different book based on the beginning of it.
I was not expecting this moralistic chapter by chapter. Here's a lesson to teach you children. And I mean, that's essentially what the first few chapters are, until it really gets into the whole father coming back, Mr. Brooke, mostly when they meet Laurie. Laurie is the catalyst for a lot of the plot at the end of part one. But the first few chapters are just, Joe, here's why you fucked up. And kids, here's why you're all going to hell unless you repent.
So this book is... It opens with an epigram from John Bunyan's A Pilgrim's Progress.
Yeah, what's the deal with A Pilgrim's Progress? I only sort of knew what that was before I started reading this book, and now I feel like I've read it because I've read the part one of Little Women.
Katie, do you remember anything about it?
I'm trying to. I think, yeah. Didn't they keep, like, acting it out?
Yeah, it was like a game that they play.
Yeah, they like keep acting it out.
Novel. It's just about like a guy whose name is literally Christian. The main character of Pilgrim's Progress is named Christian, and he's on a pilgrimage to God, essentially, but to goodness. God. And it's like the Phantom Tollbooth, but way more annoying.
You know, the thing is, though, when I read that as a young child, I remember me, my sister, and my cousins would act out the scene from Mulan. You know, where she gets, like, put in front of the matchmaker, that whole song.
Aww.
We would act that out just over and over and over. Just, like, every time we went over to my cousin's house. And I did connect with that. I'm like, yeah, you know, you just pick something and you make everyone act it out. And, like, you know, my cousin refused to ever be the matchmaker, so, like, someone else had to be it. And, like, you know, Amy always gets, like, the worst parts. I was just like, yeah, this makes total sense to me.
That is very real. Like, that is definitely like, very much childhood. It's obvious, though, that the influences they get are pretty boring.
Yes. I know.
I get it. Yeah. Your one book is Pilgrim's Progress. You're going to like it. But
exactly. And you're just going to.
Let's get some. I mean, they literally get the Bible for Christmas, right?
They get a copy of The Pilgrim's Progress.
I know. Okay, so there we go. And that's why I liked Amy. Amy was like, you know what? Like, I'm sick of this. This family's so boring. We're poor. I'm going to try to make something of myself. And Joe's like, oh, Amy, you just want them to like you. And she's like, no, I'm trying to, like, do something different with my life. And that's why.
Let's talk about how they're poor, but they have a servant.
Right, yeah. Somehow they managed to
fake
keep Hannah on payroll.
Yeah, they're like middle class people, but they used to be friends with exclusively rich people, so now it's like, oh, they're poor.
They're Trump voters.
They've fallen.
Whoa.
That's what you're saying.
That might come up later.
I mean, the beginning was really promising before I knew what this book was. I was like, oh, here they are. They're complaining about poor. Amy seems really woke. She's talking about why the rich girls shouldn't have so many presents and poor girls deserve presents too. And I'm like, yeah, I'm on board with this. Like, here's the class war
I want. At Amy and they're like, why aren't you happy with what you have?
Right. And yeah, of course.
But then also at the beginning, she's like, they're like, let's buy Marmy presents. And Amy's like, I'm going to buy her like half a present and keep the rest of the money to buy myself stuff.
You know, I mean, good for her.
I'm like Meg. It was so boring. Anyway.
Yeah
Meg, no one is ever a Meg because what is Meg's personality?
Meg gets literally written off, so... But I just want to say, Beth comes out strong in the first chapter, where her first words are, we've got father and mother and each other, so stop complaining.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's like, shut up, Beth.
Exactly.
So basically what's happening is all these girls are just wandering around in life, like... learning moral lessons, whatever. They end up giving their Christmas breakfast to a family called the Hummels, who are legitimately poor.
Yes. Yeah.
They live in a Hummel, and they have no food.
The Germans.
Yes, the Germans.
Real 19th century...
how the other half lives business right there. I guess that's early 20th, but you get it. So that's what's happening. It's all very moralistic and whatever. And then... they go to a party for New Year's. Joe and Meg go to a party, and they meet the neighbor boy, Lori Lawrence. Well, Theodore Lawrence.
Teddy Lawrence.
Teddy Lawrence, which is also a ridiculous name.
All the names that aren't the Marches in this book are just really obvious. Like, Ned Moffat is
the
prim.
Yuppie.
Yeah. The prim dork. It's like, yeah, of course, his name is Ned Moffat. Of course this guy's going to be a goon.
So Joe meets Lori and they become friends because they're at a party and they're both kind of like awkward and they end up sitting in like a closet of some sort or like a tiny drawing
room. Yeah. Literally
we
behind
can talk
a curtain.
About that later.
Yeah. This is some Polonius business.
Of Joe.
Yes, yes.
I will say, but anyway.
Yes, yeah, we're definitely going to talk about that in part two. We have to.
No spoilers, guys.
I know. Right, because you've never read the book. So they meet and they sit in the closet and they like make fun of everybody basically. Like that's the foundation of their relationship.
Totally. Sounds like a good hang.
Yeah. I feel like that. Yeah. I'd be friends with Lori for life if that happened, which Joe is. So.
I do want to mention one thing before they go to the party, which was a memorable scene, at least to me, is when they're Joe and Meg are preparing for the party, and Joe literally, she's doing some sort of 19th century hair straightening for Meg. I don't know exactly what boiling. That is.
It's like yeah. a boiling hot rod that yeah. uses wraps. Yeah. like but a iron.
She literally bar. Burns Meg's hair off. And when I read that, I was like, oh, she totally did that on purpose. Like,
no.
If you're like teenage sisters, you totally burn your hair, sister's hair
no,
on purpose,
Joe does
right?
not no, do
Joe loved
purpose.
Meg.
Joe does love Meg.
Yeah, she loves it, but like, I mean, if I had a sister, I would burn her hair off.
Well, I think well, you're an Amy. I think we've just wow. discovered yeah, that you're an Amy.
No, I am a Beth. I am adamant about that.
That is untrue on every level. But I think that was supposed to indicate how clumsy and doofy Joe kind of is.
Oh, absolutely,
really
yeah.
uncomfortable all the time. Her gloves are stained, so she and Meg have to split a pair because right. hers are too dirty. She can't. The reason she's in the closet in the first place is because the back of her dress is burned,
oh,
so
yeah.
she can't dance.
Yeah, why are so many things getting burned? Like, I guess in the 19th century, there's just a lot of open fire. But
yeah, it is back in the day.
Yeah, you ironed clothes by just putting an iron on a fire for hours and hours, and then you took it off, and then you ironed clothes and you put it back on the fire. Oh. That's how it goes.
Yeah, I mean, fair, I guess.
Though I do like that you're kind of attributing, because this book is pretty moralistic, and everyone tends to act in the best
everyone
possible
is,
way.
When I started this book, I was so mad about how nice everyone was. I just wanted people to be a little more dickish. We'll get to this and when I came around on the book. But particularly in the beginning, everyone is just like, oh, I love you. I'll be nice to you. I was like, no, come on. You guys are teenagers. Be dicks.
Be dicks.
But should we talk about Laurie? Because this is the first time we see Laurie, right?
Yeah.
And he's great. He's a great hang.
Yeah. Him and he's Joe, like younger. He's like a younger.
Yeah, he's like Joe's dashing. Age, I think. He's 15.
Yeah, 15, yeah. Which this is like, no 15-year-old boy right. is cool. Sorry.
Right, yeah, no, fair.
I mean, every one of my high school friends, like, sorry.
As a former 15-year-old boy. Right, that's his whole thing, is that yeah. he's like, oh, I'm not like these American boys. I'd rather be in Italy. It's like, all right, Laurie, you're fun, but like, shut up. Cool.
Shut up, Laurie.
I feel like that is your main reaction to this book so far, is everyone should just shut up.
Yeah, Beth, shut up. Laurie, cool it. Yeah, everyone, stop being so nice. Let's...
Well, speaking of people who aren't nice, so she becomes friends with Laurie, and then eventually Joe becomes friends with Laurie, and then eventually she goes to his house, and he's rich, where he lives with
right.
his rich grandfather.
But they're literally right next door.
Yeah, so which is like, obviously the Marches are not poor, they are just people who are trying to live according to their former standard of living, but doing it badly because they don't have enough money. Like, just
right.
downsize, move to a different house.
They said they
Whatever.
Used to be rich, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and now, like, their father was like, either nobly took a worse job, or like... got fired or something?
No, he, like, lost all of his money trying to bail out a friend's investment
oh,
or
yeah.
something.
Because he's so nice.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much.
Also, if they live right next door to Laurie, how have they never met him?
Well, they have met him. Like, Joe met him when she had to get a cat bet, one of the best cats.
Oh, yeah, one of
him.
The best
so he
weird
was, like,
cat.
He was, like, a shut-in. He was, like, Rapunzel.
Yes,
his
he
grandfather
was like
kept him in his room, and he wasn't
that
allowed to play.
That is an interesting reversal, is that Joe right. rescues him from the bed. She throws a snowball at the window, and then right. she goes up to him.
Okay.
But they talk about cricket. Like, she goes to get the cat back, and she gets it from him, and they talk about cricket.
Yes.
All right, so he's an invalid who has also been to Europe.
Yeah, but he's not an invalid.
He's
just like,
he was just
no, but,
his grandfather yeah. was like, "You need to focus on your studies."
Yeah, yeah, and piano
with Mr. Brooke, who is his tutor when he is 15, which is important later.
Oh my god!
Yes.
So okay, so she goes to the house. Finally, she goes into the house after she's befriended Laurie at this party, and she meets Grandfather Lawrence, who's I guess like a grizzled old man, and it's very
he's
much
gruff,
like,
but he has sparkling yeah. eyes.
Yeah, I imagine him as the Santa from Miracle on 34th Street.
Weird, but okay.
Yeah, that was just
so okay.
my mind picture of him.
So then they just become friends. Like, in over, like, two chapters, the Lawrences and the Marches just become best friends.
I mean, they're neighbors. They create that little post box where they can send notes to each other back
yeah.
and forth, which, mm-hmm. I mean, it's fun. I would do that as a kid, too, but you also literally live right next door to them. Just take your letter over to them.
They can't text.
Yeah,
and there's no fair. Magic in just walking up to someone and being like, hey, I wrote you this note. Like, why can't you just tell me? I'm looking at you right now.
Yeah, well, they should have thought about that.
It's fun. It's fun, Ben.
It is fun.
It is fun. I mean, as a 15-year-old child, I probably would have done it too.
And then Beth wins the heart of Grandfather Lawrence.
Yeah.
He gives
yeah.
her a piano. Yeah. It's all very sweet.
He literally gives her a piano.
Yeah, it's very yeah. Little Princess.
Yeah.
Do you ever read Little
Princess? God, I love Little Princess.
Ben?
No, I have not. I've got all these blind spots.
Oh, Ben, you got it.
We'll do a later episode of Little Princess.
Little Princess is actually a perfect follow-up to Little Women, so I'm going to suggest that for you.
We're going to go now into, like, the moral lessons part of the book, where they all have these really intense chapter names, like Amy's Valley of Humiliation.
This is where the book gets good. This is where I turned on it, and I was like, yeah.
Amy lives for the drama.
Amy does live for the
drama. Amy lives for the pickled limes. That's what she lives for.
What? Okay.
Oh, I know.
So, when we get to this chapter, apparently, you know, how when I was in elementary school, gel pens were the thing. Like,
yeah,
everyone had gel
that.
Pens.
Oh, yeah.
And chokers were a thing. You can guess how old I am, but you know. And
gel pens.
Yeah, gel pens. For whatever reason, the trend in Amy's school is pickled limes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what is a pickled lime? What is it? Do you know what? Guess. Everyone has to guess right now what you think a pickled lime tastes like or is.
Is it literally just a lime pickled?
How could that taste good?
That sounds good.
I don't know.
It sounds good?
Yeah, I don't know. They all were about the citrus fruits back then. An orange was like a huge treat, you know?
They had to ward off scurvy.
They did. They really did.
Yeah. Okay. So what happens in this chapter is Amy buys some, she like gets Meg to give her money to buy pickled limes because there's a system of debt among her school fellows.
Yes. She's like, I've gotten ever so many limes.
And people give each other limes for friendship reasons, but she has no money, so she can't give anyone limes. So she buys like 25 limes or whatever, and then her mean, like Joy Snow or whatever, like her like bitchy classmate reports her to
her
the teacher.
Frenemy.
Her frenemy. Yeah. Reports to the teacher. And then she gets beaten with a ruler for having limes.
And he dumps the limes out the window, right?
He dumps the limes out the window. And
she complains that all the Irish children are going to eat the limes.
Well, everyone in the class is like, they hear them. Like, they hear the Irish children come to the window.
Outside.
Which is like, obviously, there's some weird stereotyping going on here.
Yeah.
It's very strange.
Oh,
I assumed, I was like, man, it's good for those Irish kids because they won't get scurvy.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Not genteelly poor.
Mean, yeah, you think, Amy, you know, they were all about giving to the poor German family in chapter one. Doesn't she want to give her...
No, Amy resisted that from the beginning. She was like,
True. Amy wants what's hers.
She wants what's hers, and I appreciate that.
And then she's extremely humiliated for doing this, but it's also unclear, like, is the moral lesson here that she shouldn't have done it, or is it because then her family's like, wow, that teacher is really a dick.
Yeah, I'm not really sure. Like, the
outcome
is that...
They immediately take her out of school.
Right. The outcome is... I think the lesson is, Amy, you should not have been going to school.
Yeah, because she just gets to, like, not go to school ever again.
I think the lesson is that Amy should not be so concerned with, like, social graces and should just work on being humble and, like, not worry about, like, being popular. That would always seem to be, like, the lesson Amy has to learn is that she's too concerned with popularity, too concerned with how she looks.
Ah, you sound like Marmy right now.
Yeah, that's Max, too, though.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't think that's fair.
I don't blame Amy for. I mean, she's also what, 13?
Yeah,
she's
exactly.
not even 13. Isn't she younger
she's like
than Beth?
Nine, I think.
Yeah, she's like nine or 10.
Oh, Amy's the youngest?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I guess
Beth is just so weak. I was just she's the youngest.
Beth is so weak.
I don't think Beth ever learned to walk. So.
Stop it.
Well, they all...
Her heart's inflamed, okay?
That's, like, the whole thing is that they're really all childlike for most of the book. So when everyone starts talking about crushes, like, even in Harry Potter, they all make out with someone before anyone in this book even knows what making out is.
I know.
It's true.
God.
So now everyone has all these issues with each other. And I really do think that the reason there's a dichotomy between Amy and Joe is because they have the strongest personalities and are the most developed characters.
Absolutely, yep.
Beth, like we said, is basically a figurine, a China figurine on the wall. Like, she's nothing. And then Meg is, like, an amorphous blob of pleasantness.
Yeah, Meg is fine. Meg is thoroughly fine.
Yeah, but Meg's struggles are similar to Amy's. Like, they both are pretty women who are too concerned with their prettiness or with people thinking they have money. Except for Amy is, well... We'll just get here now. Amy is just a sociopath.
Amy is an asshole.
So she gets mad because Meg and Joe, because they're older, so they get to do things. They go to a play with Lori, and Amy doesn't get to go. And she's so upset that this is one of, I think, the watershed moment for many people about this book is that she burns Joe's manuscript that Joe has been working on for years.
Because Joe is, do we establish that Joe is the writer? Oh, she is Alcott's.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whatever.
Allegory there.
Yeah.
This is literally the chapter where I said, okay, I'm in on this book. This is maybe my favorite chapter in the whole, at least in part one, certainly.
she, I mean, Amy burns the book and Joe doesn't forgive her. And I'm like, yeah. And yeah. Everyone's like, you should get over it right away. No, Joe, you should never get over it. That's how I feel.
That is, Amy is just so cutthroat.
She's so cutthroat.
And then she also tries to deny it, where I was so like, did you burn my manuscript? She's like, me? No, of course not. And then everyone's like, Amy, you totally burned her manuscript.
And then the crazy thing that happens after that is Amy once again manipulates Joe into forgiving her by following her onto the ice, because Joe goes skating with Lori to take her mind off of how mad she is at Amy, and Amy follows her and falls through the ice, and then Joe has to save her, and like, she almost doesn't, but she has
right. That's the best part, is that Joe almost doesn't save Amy, where she's like, there's this whole paragraph where Joe's like, Joe saw Amy, she knew Amy was there, she knew Amy was going onto the ice where she shouldn't have been, and she just, you know, kept staring forward, she didn't turn around, she just kept going, and the implication, I think, is there that Joe would have let Amy drown. And I was like, yes, I am here for this. Oh, Amy's a dick. Joe's going to let her drown. I am here for this drama. I love this. But then, of course, Lori does, you know, I think they get a stick and pull her out.
Yeah, and she helps, and Joe gets all cut up, whatever. But here's why I think Amy is a sociopath. Katie, let me know how you feel about this.
Okay.
But, like, okay, obviously Amy did not intend to fall through the ice. But when she does, like, you can't be mad at her anymore because she almost died. So it's like, all right, Amy, you did this really shitty thing. But now we all have to be like, oh, we're so grateful that you're alive. As opposed to be like, I'm still mad at you. When she still objectively did a bad thing. Like, she just puts herself back in the victim role, which is so manipulative.
You know, I kind of love that.
There's no Trump move, like, almost dying.
He's a genius. Like, I don't know. I mean, just whatever. I just think as the book goes on, her ability to manipulate situations, I think, becomes more impressive. And I guess that's what I appreciated about her. I'm like, you know what? Amy has, like, some social graces that the rest of this family lacks. They're all so boring. You know? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I will say,
like,
Amy knows.
Is like manipulative, and she like knows how to get into places where she wouldn't otherwise get to go, and I appreciate that about her.
Yeah, Amy knows what she's doing.
She knows what she's doing, yes. And whereas Joe is just like, I don't know how to act around people. I think that's also, I mean, that's a whole other discussion, this whole introvert culture we have going right now that I have a huge problem with.
I also think that Joe's introversion is not introversion. She just is a straightforward, blunt person, and she doesn't do the whole thing that's like, oh, your ringlets are so charming. She's like, why don't you wear a hat? And it's like, that's rude.
Exactly.
And that's how she is. And some people, like Aunt March, so they have this rich relative, Aunt March, who Joe works for as
Which
like a companion.
Weird.
Yeah. And she's also a crotchety person, and so is Joe. So they, and just like how Joe and Lori make fun of people in a closet, like Aunt March also likes to talk shit. So they get along. And Amy is only going to talk shit if she knows that it's going to somehow benefit her directly, as opposed to her just expressing her opinions, I feel.
Amy's always out to get something.
Yes.
I respect that, but she is stone cold diabolical.
She is a sociopath.
I respect it.
All right. So later in this book, we've learned all these things about them. We're getting a little closer. Meg gets to go to a fancy party with her rich friend.
There we go.
Yeah. She like befriends her rich friend, and she goes, and she's really excited about her clothes, and everyone there likes her because she's pretty, friendly, or whatever.
It's been established that she is
very
good looking.
She's the prettiest one.
Yeah.
I mean, she's also the oldest, so I think it's by default.
Yeah, because they're all so young,
Which
is why this is creepy. But so she goes to the party, and at the last night, it's a fancier dress ball, and she's wearing this dress to one of the other parties, and they're like, oh, is that the only dress you have? And then the older sister, who's engaged, and they're like, oh, engagement. Like,
isn't it Amy Moffat or something like
that? Her name is Belle.
Belle? Of
course. Her friend was Sally, right?
Sally is her friend.
Yeah.
And then Belle is like the sister of the girl whose house they're at.
Right.
So what is this? This is just like a week of parties? Like,
have you never read a 19th century novel?
They're always going to parties.
Clearly not.
Everyone just stays at each other's houses for like
they
weeks.
They do. It's so weird.
Yeah. And they like go to dances and drink tea.
Yeah. It's a different life, I guess.
Yeah. And they have to go, and the women and the men are segregated after dinner, and they have to do different things.
Well, I think Meg let Sally dress her, right? So she's wearing one of Sally's dresses, and she's like drinking. I remember, wasn't she drinking?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So You get stressed
up. She was
wearing
makeup, she was drinking, and she was enjoying herself. And then Lori has to show up and be like, this is different for you.
Yes, so she's like, gets really dressed up, and everyone's like, oh, you look so pretty. And then Meg looks in the mirror, and she's like, oh my god, I look so pretty. And then, like you said, Lori shows up, and he like glowers at her, some trash.
He's like, I never thought that you were like this.
Yeah, I'm gonna find the quote. Oh, so Joe's like, so Lori's like, Joe wanted me to come and tell her how you looked, so I did. And he's like, and she says, don't you like me? And he says, no, I don't. And then she's like, why? And he says, I don't like fuss and feathers, which is, that's 100% a dude who tweets at a random woman that says, you know, I prefer girls who don't wear makeup.
Look, let's just put it out there. Lori's a fuckboy. He's just, yeah, he is. He's a fuckboy. Right.
is Lori a fuckboy?
Yes.
Why?
Because I was reading, I was doing some research on this earlier. I was like, is Lori a fuckboy? And I was looking for the definition of fuckboy. And it's like a man / boy who is just like a vampire on women who just like sucks their attention and then is a dick to them and very dismissive. And, you know, I like Lori, and he has some good moments in this book, but he's just like, he's the March's fuckboy.
I don't really necessarily
dismissive of the girls. He really does love them. He just has this like attitude where he's like, these are my women.
Right. Does he love them or does he love their attention? Does he love that they dote on him and say, oh, Lori's a boy?
But here's the thing though. We can never know if Lori would be a true fuckboy because of what happens later, which you don't know. But so
I mean, I know Joe and Lori are gonna fuck. I know that. Like that
well,
is telegraphed.
So okay, we can discuss this more in the second episode. But the thing about it is that Lori is still true to them. Like a fuckboy ghosts. Lori does not ghost.
Right. Yeah.
Yes, he doesn't leave them.
He is definitely a nice guy. I think he's a capital N, capital G nice guy.
Yeah, that's so true. He's definitely a nice guy.
He is, he's worried about getting friend zoned.
Yes. Yeah, he definitely is worried about getting friend zoned. But also because he says things that he thinks are woke, but are in fact still centering him and what he wants.
Yeah.
You know? That's what it is. He's just like, oh, well, women shouldn't have to, like, instead of being like, women shouldn't have to do this, the subtext is still like, but why don't women do things that I like.
Yeah.
Right, because Ned Moffat, this is where we meet Ned Moffat, one of the society types, is super into Meg, like at all aspects of this night. He's like just following her around constantly, and he's on her dance card 3 times. He's into the dress and the weird makeup.
Not
he
Ned.
Also probably sucks, but
Ned Moffat is shooting his shot. He's doing it.
He is shooting his shot. So that is the case. I do think that, for me at least, I don't know about you, Katie, because, well, anyway, I always kind of idealized Lori. I don't want to spoil anything for Ben, but I was kind of idealized Lori as like a male partner, and rereading this as an adult, I was like, wait a second.
No, I totally agree. I think also, I mean, like, unfortunately, they're all fixed in my mind as like, well, he's Christian Bale. He's a young Christian Bale from the movie, and Marmee's Susan Sarandon. Right. So like, well, yeah, when you try to like hate on Marmee, I'm like, no, Susan. I can't say that about Susan. But he was so charming. He was so sweet. You know, just like long limbed and like dashing. And I was like,
yeah. Because Lori is supposed to be handsome, right? He's supposed
to be handsome. Yeah.
Yeah, he's a handsome guy.
He's a handsome guy. And I mean, like, the chemistry between him and Joe is undeniable. But again,
it is. It's the sexual tension is palpable in part.
It is undeniable. But anyway.
It really is. It's really infuriating. All right. Okay. So we kind of get sucked into their lives a little bit more, and they have this club, the Pickwick Club.
This is the most fun the book gets, I think.
Yeah, I think so. And they have this little club. Before we get to that, it like starts with them talking about their gardening that they have, and Hannah, their maid, we have to talk about Hannah, because it opens this chapter with her talking about their different gardening plots, and this is what she says. I'm going to read it as it is written in the book with the weird speech affectations. I'd know which each of them gardings belonged to if I see them in Chiny. Like, what?
Yeah, I don't know what is going on. I don't
know
what
else. How J.K. Rowling decided to write Hagrid throughout the entire 7 books. It was so distracting.
Yes, it's
unfortunate, but yeah. But again, you know, I love it. I love the categorization, like the 4 gardens. Like Beth's was obviously beautiful. Like Amy's was a little more distracted. Or like Joe's was more like tumbleweeds and whatever. You know, I just love it.
But I'm like, what is I need to know what the deal is with Hannah. Like, Hannah is their servant, but they're poor, but she's also basically family.
Maybe she straight up was not, she was not getting paid. She might just be living there.
Right. But she also later, she gets days off.
Yeah.
Oh,
so there's
does.
Some sort of employment agreement.
Yeah. But... and like, why does she talk like this?
Yeah.
It seems really strange. I mean, I get the sense from, we learn her last name a little bit later, which is Mullet, but sometimes it's Brown. It depends. It changes. Like, Mullet, she might, and considering how Alcott feels about the Irish in this book, maybe she's Irish, and this is, like, one of her weird anti-Irish, like, things.
Oh, my God.
I don't know why she talks like this. It's, like, very strange to me.
It is clearly supposed to be showing
it's like
lower
a low-class
education.
Accent.
Yeah, low
yeah.
class.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is not the most graceful part of this book, I would say.
Definitely not.
Right.
A little questionable.
It actually makes me really uncomfortable.
Yeah, I when I first started reading, I assumed Hannah, or I thought Hannah was supposed to be African-American. I thought it was supposed to be, like, a servant thing. And I was like, this is weird. They're supposed to be, you know, for the North, and they have this, you know, not slave, but, and I was like, this Alcott should not be writing like this.
I mean, maybe it's like you said before, is that she really wanted a lot of people to buy this book, so you could kind of, if that's how you think this is going, you could fill in the picture that way yourself.
Yeah.
Which is, you know... a little frustrating, I think, and uncomfortable, and something I don't really remember from when I read it as a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hannah.
Class war. Never came.
Never came. Should have.
Let's write. Okay. We'll talk about this at the show, but we need to figure out a sequel that's just about Hannah. Hannah's journey.
Hannah's revenge.
Hannah's truth. Hannah's freedom. Right? Hannah's life. Hannah deserves a life.
I'd be so pissed if I was Hannah. Like, these marches are just, you know, complaining all the time, and they're just like, ah, we're so poor. You're not that poor. I'm your servant. Yeah. Stop complaining about being poor.
I'm poor. I make like
one
poor, penny.
If you're poor, then what am I?
Yeah. And wages at the time, I'm sure she made like a dollar a week.
Yeah, if that.
Nothing. Yeah. Well, considering how much... yes. Anyway. Okay, so she talks about the garden. We're all like, this is weird. Hannah, this Hannah thing is weird. And then we learn that the girls have a newspaper that they publish under their pseudonyms.
Yeah. Yes. The pseudonyms are great.
Yes.
This is based on Dickens, right? Pickwick Papers?
Yeah, Pickwick Papers, yeah.
This is the most fun that I think the book gets. And it's so weirdly specific that Alcott had to do something like this as a child.
I would imagine.
This has to be pulled from real life.
It was so sweet. Wasn't there like an ad for like a missing Reuben?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was really cute. I remember that specifically.
Should we read their names?
Yeah, let's read their names.
So Meg, as the eldest, was Samuel Pickwick. You know, ostensibly the... editor-in-chief of the Pickwick Papers.
Cute.
Joe, being of a literary turn, was Augustus Snodgrass. That was a very Joe name. Beth, because she was round and rosy, was Tracy Tupman. And Amy, who was also always trying to do what she couldn't, was Nathaniel Winkle.
Yeah, I definitely identify as a Nathaniel Winkle.
Oh, I guess, according to my footnote in my book, these are all actual characters from the Pickwick Papers.
Yeah, of course they are.
Oh, I guess that makes sense. I thought, you know, Augustus Snodgrass sounds like a made-up name. I mean, I guess it literally is a made-up name, so... Well, anyway, yeah.
I guess it is. Well, my favorite part is when they write a poem to the cat that disappeared.
Yeah.
It's not even dead. It's just like someone maybe
stole it. Finally escaped Beth's grasp.
I think they had like 10 cats in that house at all times.
Because Beth was a cat hoarder.
Yeah, they barely like dealt with it. They just lived like around the house.
So I'm wondering, like, when Joe, at the beginning of the book, Joe takes, because Lori's sick or whatever, she takes a basket of kittens over to him. Did she just leave them there? She's like, okay, they're your problem now. Bye.
That was how they did things back in the day. They're always just, like, dogs and cats just in and out in the neighborhood.
This is truly the most charming part of the book, and I wish it had just gone on forever, because then we have to deal with the chapter Experiments, which I hate, which is so long, and it's really just like four girls want to have a vacation, and their mom is like, no, if you don't work and do your duty, your life will be fruitless, and it's so long, and it just ends with Marmee descending from the stairs being like, no, haven't you learned something about hard work? I hate
Marmee, they like don't do their chores. Yeah, okay, I forgot.
Yeah,
they don't do their chores, and they're like, oh, actually, this is unpleasant.
Yes, Marmee, this is where I learned that Marmee is full of shit.
Everyone loves Marmee, so
everyone's mom is full of shit.
I can't stand Marmee. Her whole shtick is her coming down at the end of the chapter being like, oh, you girls are in trouble? Oh, I knew this would happen. Then where, like, why didn't you say something, Marmy? Like, what are you doing? Come on. Like, you can't say, oh, I knew this would happen after it happens. That's bullshit.
I mean, I guess the thing with her is that she's trying to teach her kids how to live good and decent
lives. But everything is moral condescension with her.
Yes.
She could, you know.
Because they're like, Marmy, how is it that nothing bad, you never do anything bad? She's like, oh, I am very impatient, but I've worked so hard with the Lord to marshal my feelings. And it's like, you're so smug about how great you are.
She literally says, oh, I'm good because of your father. Again,
oh my God.
I'm assuming the allegory for the father is God.
Is actually God. Yeah. Because he's never there.
Right.
God, he's not there, but he somehow is going to know. Yeah. If this book had ended at part one, it would have been like Waiting for Godot, basically.
Yeah, because they literally are just every chapter is, oh, when father comes back, we will finally be whole.
Yeah, and it's infuriating. And I kind of, you know, I kind of agree. Like, I do have memories being like, oh, Marmy, like, how great. And I'm like, oh,
fuck,
just like live a little. Like, Meg should be able to have a glass of champagne.
Yes.
Everyone leave Meg alone.
Yes, I agree with that.
So, okay. So then, as we discussed, Mr. March, surprisingly not dead, but might die because he gets camp fever, I guess. Pneumonia.
They get a telegram and it just says, your husband is very sick. Please come.
So Marmy goes to DC with Mr. Brooke, who gets sent along. But before she goes, everyone's like, what can we get? What can we bring? And Joe disappears and Lori has to go find her, but he can't find her. And it turns out that Joe, who this entire time has had this like beautiful long chestnut hair, cuts it all off and sells it in a very O. Henry moment in the book. And she gets $25 for all of her hair.
Which is weird that, you know, humans can just go and sell their hair like that.
This is very much like a 19th century thing of like women selling their hair. It's a huge, huge motif in literature.
Great.
They also call it her one beauty. Like somehow Joe is super ugly.
How could you? Your one beauty. Yeah, that was Marmy.
Yeah. Marmy scold her for it?
Amy does. No, Marmy doesn't scold her. She's like, Joe, how could you? But of course I love you. Everyone, it's just a very heightened moment. Everyone's saying things they don't mean.
Yes. And she gets the money and she's really sad. And then she cries about it later that she cut off her hair. And
That was a very human moment because she's like, I'm tough. Yes. I can do whatever. But she's like, you know what? That hurt.
Speaking of nice things, it's Christmas again or something. I don't really remember.
Yet again.
Yes. Because part one takes place over the course of a year.
Yeah.
So the Hummels are back. The actual
the poor Germans.
Yeah, they're back. So we go to the Hummels and apparently this entire time, literally the entire book, it's never been mentioned again though, but before that they've been visiting them like every week and bringing them food and helping them. Just like the entire book.
Is it everyone or just Beth?
No, it's everybody. Like Marmy has been going and she's been saying, oh, don't forget when I go to DC, like don't forget to keep checking in on the Hummels, even though for this entire book, it's been completely unclear that this has been happening. So everyone's like, oh, I'm tired. Like, mom's not here. We can dick around if we want to. Oh, I'm tired. So everyone's like, I'm not going. And Beth is like, oh, maybe Meg will go. Maybe Joe will go. Maybe Amy will go. But nobody goes. So Beth goes. And then it gets really dark. It gets really dark and Dickensian here. She goes to the family. She's taking care of this sick baby. And it dies in her arms.
In her arms. She is holding the baby as its life leaves it.
Oh,
yes. And she's like,
God.
I think this baby is dead. And they're like, oh, no, let's call a doctor. And she's right. The baby is dead. And it turns out that the baby had scarlet fever. And I guess this is like, no one has scarlet fever anymore. So it's like chickenpox, et cetera, which is if you've had it, you can't get it again. But Beth has not had it. So she's now at risk for scarlet fever.
Yep.
Yeah. And she gets it.
She gets it. She has it really bad.
Yeah. And because Amy has never had it, Amy gets sent to live with Anne March.
Yes.
Right.
Which is important.
Beth is dying in their house, but the girls don't want to tell Marmy because they don't want to bring Marmy back from their dying father.
Yeah.
So everybody's dying. It's the end of part one. It's like, you know, sweeps week. They're pulling out the stops.
So spoiler alert. Beth lives.
Beth
through the scarlet fever.
Unfortunately lives.
Joe thinks she's dead, but actually it's the fever breaking.
Yeah. Oh my God.
So she
lives
and thanks to Lori interfering with their lives, Marmy comes home right at the time that like Beth is better.
Yes.
Yes.
It's this happy ending. I think Alcott literally writes something like, such moments, no one knows more happiness than in such moments.
That's exactly what she wrote.
Marmy, go away.
So that seems like a natural ending point for part one, but that's not where it ends. No, no, no. So Mr. Brooke and Marmy come back and they all like talk about how great Mr. Brooke is and he's such a good man, whatever, whatever. And then we remember that earlier in the book, Lori told Joe a secret, which is that creepily, Mr. Brooke, like he, so earlier in their post office, they get deliveries and Meg gets back half of a pair of gloves that she left at Lori's. She's like, why is there only one? So weird. And they're like, we never found the other one. But it turns out all this time, Lori has known that the other glove has been in the possession of Mr. Brooke.
Oh my
the 16-year-old's glove has been in with the probably 20-something tutor's possession.
Yes. Yes. So
he's just smelling it.
But the real gossip here is when Lori is a little bit of a mischief maker and he writes some fake love letters to Meg from Mr. Brooke and upsets Joe because Joe is like, Meg's going to leave us. She's
right. Meg does, Joe does not want Meg to be married.
No.
Joe wants to keep the gang together.
Joe is correct in assuming that marriage is a shit deal for women.
Yes.
So he's like, why would anyone do this? I'm like, you know what, Joe? Why?
Yeah.
Why indeed?
But they do get engaged at the end.
They
of
do get
one.
Engaged.
Meg and Mr. Brooke.
In a sort
creepily,
of, yeah.
Mostly because Aunt March tells Meg not to, so Meg's like, oh, I'm going to do it if you say no.
Oh, yeah, because she's like, he's a teacher.
Right. And she's also a teen, so of course she's going to rebel by marrying a tutor. I want to talk about the last line of part
one. Okay, let's discuss.
Because I love the way that Alka ended this, where she said, so grouped, the curtain falls upon Meg, Joe, Beth, and Amy. Whether it ever rises again depends upon the reception given to the first act of the domestic drama called Little Women, where she is literally just saying,
like, if you guys want more,
you better fucking buy this book.
Yeah.
Wow, I totally forgot about that.
That's awesome.
Good for
her. I really like that. All books should end like that.
I mean, she did write this just to be like, no one pays attention to me and I really want to make money.
Yeah.
So I'm going to write this thing that everyone can like. And she was right. Everyone does.
She did. Yeah. She was successful.
So that's the end of part one of Little Women. That's the end of part one for us. Now, at the end of each episode, we're going to play a little game. We have come up with some segments, but they're all really fun. We can never really decide how we want to do one. So we just have a six-sided die and we're going to roll it. And depending on what we roll, we're going to get one of these games. Sometimes we will substitute other games based on how relevant it is to the situation. So here are the games. It could be any one of these seven. I'll let you know which ones we subbed in. We've got Wow, This Got Racist, which we will highlight.
As many 19th century books do.
The weird racist part of these books. Two, Who Dies. We will predict who we think will die. Three, Who's Gonna Bang?
Yes.
Which often happens in these books. Four, Would You Rather, which are Would You Rather questions that are anticipated by the book. Five, Pitch the Bad Gritty Reboot, because it is time to pitch gritty reboots. Six, Describe Your Favorite Fanfic Version, or like the fanfic you would write of this book. And seven, Who Goes Nazi, which is based on an article from the 40s from Harper's, which is about people who would become Nazis.
Yes.
Check it out. Great article. And we will discuss it. Which character would go Nazi? Were this book set at a different time? So, Ben, do you want to roll?
I will roll, sure.
All right.
Four.
Four, would you rather? Okay, so we'll all answer these would you rather questions. And we're going to start with, would you rather marry Mr. Brooke or Ned Moffat? Katie?
I'm going to say Mr. Brooke. He's just, he's a known quantity. I mean, yeah, right? What's up with Ned Moffat?
I mean, I know he likes champagne, so
yeah,
I'm going to pick Ned Moffat.
He's an alcoholic and he's going to turn violent later in life. So.
Wow. I assumed he was a party boy and was weak-willed so I could control him and also drink champagne.
Yeah, I'm with Ned. I don't know. I respect his...
you know, two sides of the same coin.
Yeah. All right. So two for Ned. Two for Ned, one for Mr. Brooke. All right. So at one point in this book, Joe brings Lori some blancmange, which is something I frequently hear about in 19th century novels. I don't know what it is. I did not intentionally did not look it up because I don't care. So would you rather eat a pickled lime or blancmange?
I want to try that pickled lime. I'm very curious.
Yeah, I got to see what the rage is. All the kids are doing it.
I know.
I want a pickled lime too because blancmange, Joe's like, oh, it's soft. You can eat it when you're six. So it sounds gross.
Just like porridge?
And blanc is just like white and
fresh.
It's sort of gelatin.
So maybe it's like, you know how in England they have puddings, which are actually just animal fat?
Oh, yeah.
Like a soup pudding. It's just straight up kidney fat around other things. Like what is, I don't know what a blancmange is, but I feel like it could be something kind of disgusting.
Yeah, I'm going with the lime.
And finally, the most serious question of would you rather is, would you rather die of scarlet fever or die as a casualty in the Civil War?
Civil War.
Oh.
Yeah,
I'll take the war
for a cause.
I feel like that would be really gruesome. I mean
you know, that would be awful.
You know, high casualties. You probably have a leg amputated with no anesthesia.
Bayoneted.
A mini A ball, which explodes in your body.
Yeah, but you know, I'd rather have that than dying quickly, almost dying.
Whereas
like
Beth just her quality of life was completely gone. But we can talk about that more.
Beth is functionally no different as being alive than dying.
You never know in this book, though, how anyone would die in the Civil War, because Mr. March does not have a grievous wound. He does not come back shell-shocked. He has no PTSD. He like comes home from Christmas and he's like, I'm back from the worst war in America's history. And guess what? I love you all. Like, what? Okay.
Yeah, the realities of the Civil War was...
Yeah.
Excised from this book.
Definitely. I'm going to say Scarlet Fever, because as it's portrayed in this book, it's
a
very...
A coward's way out.
It's very much a 19th century, like, invalid illness, which is, like, the symptoms seem to actually not be that grotesque. It's just, like, lying around in your bed and being dramatic.
Fair, yeah, yeah.
So, sure.
Such
sure.
a Beth.
I have the drama.
What a time. Ridiculous. What a time to be alive, or rather to die of Scarlet Fever.
If you like this podcast and you would like to answer the Would You Rather questions yourself, you can add us on Twitter at CannonballsPod. That's C-A-N-O-N, balls with a Z, pod.
I will say Amy and Joe would be awful on Twitter for different reasons, but awful.
Joe is not on Twitter. Joe's on Tumblr, let's be real.
Yeah, Joe's on Tumblr. Awful. Amy's a party promoter.
Amy is an Instagram influencer.
She's an Instagram 100%. Influencer, absolutely.
Wow. That is all so accurate.
That might be
I don't
something
know what
to talk
to do
about.
With myself.
And Meg is just, you
Meg
know,
is
posting
a,
about.
Yeah, one of those very creative Amish housewives.
Meg
like
has a mommy blog.
Yeah, mommy
yeah she,
blog.
Has a, she has her craft blog that she links to on Facebook.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Not Amish. Why did I say Amish? Mormon. I meant Mormon.
Well, I think that's all accurate. We'll find out if any of that comes true in the next episode, and we'll see you next time.